Support for WYPR comes from University of Maryland Medical System, where world-class doctors are pioneering immunotherapy that's helping to stop cancer in its tracks. And with screenings and advanced treatments across the state, it's cancer care made for Marylanders. Learn more at umms.org/cancer.
And welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. By the way, coming up on the show tomorrow, it's Midday on Personal Finance with Nicholas Abrams, a certified financial planner. Nick will answer your questions about investing and wealth creation and economic empowerment. So what's the best way to approach the savings that you have and the best way to grow those savings and to formulate a plan to save even more? So Nicholas Abrams will join me tomorrow with tips for making your money work for you. And now it's the Midday Health Watch with Dr. Lena Wen. The American Academy of Pediatrics has broken ranks with the CDC in its guidelines for childhood vaccines. The Academy continues to recommend protecting kids from 18 different potentially life-threatening diseases, including COVID-19, hepatitis, and measles. The CDC guidelines issued last month took several long-standing recommendations off of the list. The cold temperatures that we've experienced in the Baltimore metro area over the last 9 days have made it one of the longest sub-freezing streaks in Baltimore history. Colds and flu are still very much in season, and we'll talk about some of the best ways to avoid problems caused by the cold and respiratory viruses, ways to stay healthy. Millions of people gave up alcohol for dry January. We'll talk about the latest research into risks associated with even light or moderate drinking with Dr. Lena Wen. She is a former health commissioner of Baltimore, a columnist on health matters for the Washington Post, a medical expert at CNN, and a scholar at George Washington University and the Brookings Institution. Dr. Wen joins us on Zoom. You are welcome to join us as well. If you have a question or a comment, give us a call, 410-662-8780, or send us an email, midday@wypr.org. Hey, Lena, welcome back. Always a pleasure.
Thank you, Tom. It's great to talk to you, as always.
So you had a piece in the Washington Post. I think it was posted this morning. The headline was, "A Ray of Hope Breaking Through RFK Jr.'s Anti-Vaccine Campaign." Talking about the American Academy of Pediatricians. Tell us what they said, what the CDC said, and why you think there's a ray of hope here.
Well, I have to say that it's a small ray of hope, but still a ray of hope nonetheless. As you mentioned, there have been quite dramatic changes to the entire vaccine infrastructure here in the U.S. The CDC just last month made major changes to its guidelines. It's no longer recommending the same number of vaccines as before. And I think it's gotten many people very worried and also confused about what recommendations they should be following, both clinicians and families. And so the American Academy of Pediatrics last week issued its own vaccine recommendations, which normally would actually not be news because they have been issuing vaccine recommendations since 1935 every year. And their recommendations this year made news because it essentially explicitly went against the CDC, went against Robert F. Kennedy Jr. And federal health officials. And what else was notable about it was that 12 other major medical organizations immediately signed on, including the American Medical Association, including the American College for Obstetricians and Gynecologists. And so I think it's really important because for the first time, it gives protection, a liability protection and professional clarity for pediatricians, for clinicians. It helps to establish standard of care and to say, hey, regardless of what the federal government is saying, this is still mainstream practice, protecting children against diseases that could be very dangerous and are highly infectious is mainstream good medical practice. And it's also guiding patients who are confused and families who are confused to say, look, all these major medical societies have signed on. This is what we believe as clinicians, and this is what we would recommend to our patients as well. And I think very importantly, this is offering a template for institutions like hospitals and state health departments who previously had relied on the CDC. So, for example, here in Maryland, we see that the state of Maryland has said that they are endorsing and following the American Academy of Pediatrics guidelines. Major hospital systems like Johns Hopkins have said that they are following the American Academy of Pediatrics. And so, look, I wish that we were not in this position. I think it's a travesty and honestly one that I couldn't have predicted would happen, that major medical societies are breaking with our federal health officials and no longer endorsing the recommendations of the CDC. But given what has happened, what I wrote about is how this is a ray of hope because it means that there is still an anchor, that there are still trusted resources that patients and families can turn to.
Yeah, it really is extraordinary. We've talked about this so many times, but it doesn't get any less extraordinary that, you know, the American Academy of Pediatrics and all these other medical societies have had to explicitly rebuke Robert F. Kennedy Jr. and the HHS and what the CDC is recommending. And that's just so extraordinary. And we have very serious outbreaks and very serious conditions of diseases that can be thwarted pretty substantially by vaccines. I mean, last season, the Washington Post is reporting that was the most severe year in many years, according to the CDC, when it comes to vaccine-preventable hospitalizations. They counted 560,000 hospitalizations and 38,000 deaths from viruses, RSV, respiratory viruses, that if people weren't getting their flu shots and stuff like that. 55,000 pediatric hospitalizations happened last year, and routine vaccinations, as you write, have cut that down by 80%. When people get their vaccinations, when little kids get their vaccinations, we have a measles outbreak, which is just getting worse by the day. This really is something, and it's going to be a real challenge for public health officials, isn't it, to get the education out there, to get folks understanding that there's a difference between what CDC is saying and what all of these medical societies are saying.
Absolutely. And look, Tom, it is the job of clinicians to answer questions. And I certainly understand that patients have questions that need to be answered and whatever concerns that they might have, whether it's something that they heard or a question that they may, a concern that they might have about vaccines, they should have those conversations. And it's in those conversations that that the clinician can establish an improved relationship based on trust and help to better advise patients. The problem, though, is that there is misinformation. And the misinformation, in fact, even stems now from the top of our federal government in charge of health. And I think that's really concerning because there are going to be parents who will listen to the American Academy of Pediatrics, who will listen to pediatricians, who will continue getting their vaccines. But there will be other patients who will say, look, I just don't know. And maybe they will put off vaccines, and that could contribute to outbreaks being worse because there won't be as much immunity in the community as we have seen in the case of measles and whooping cough and a number of other diseases. But I also fear for their children because their children who are not getting vaccinated are now going to be unprotected against a whole host of diseases. And that's just really tragic.
There were 800 cases of measles reported just in South Carolina last week. They're picking up more than 100 cases every week, and Lord knows how many cases are not being reported. So everybody's assumption is that that number is a pretty dramatic undercount. There are two detainees at the immigration, they call it a family detention center, which is south of San Antonio, Texas. This is the place where that young kid from Minneapolis, Liam Conejo Ramos. He was an Ecuadorian kid. He and his father were shipped down there from Minneapolis. Luckily, they've been returned home. But There's a measles outbreak in this immigration detention center. These are preventable problems. Measles at one point was declared to be eliminated in the United States, at least. And that's no longer the case, is it?
Well, that's exactly it. And we are already seeing, as you mentioned, this measles outbreak in South Carolina spiraling out of control. We saw last year the highest number of pediatric deaths since reporting began, excluding the 2009 to 2010 H1N1 influenza. And these are diseases that are not going away. And so I think, I commend the American Academy of Pediatrics. I commend medical societies and state health departments for working together on this, because I think that there needs to be a united front in order to help reassure parents and also to make it clear that that vaccination is not the outlier, that it's normal, right? That it is something that we have been doing for decades. It's prevented countless numbers of infections and deaths, and that this remains standard medical practice despite what may be said by federal health officials.
Dr. Lena Nguyen is with me. It's the Midday Health Watch. I'm Tom Hall. If you have a question or comment for Dr. Nguyen, we're at 410-662-8780 or by email, rather, midday@wipr.org. And the other thing, I think we talked about this last month, about the what y'all in the medical profession call off-target benefits. For senior citizens in particular, there are all sorts of these off-target benefits for vaccines for older people. There's a recent meta-analysis that was in the British Journal of Age and Aging that found that seniors who were vaccinated had reduced risks of dementia. And there was, there are some studies here that go back 25 years showing a reduced risk for cardiovascular disease if you've gotten a flu shot. So there are things, there are other benefits to getting vaccinated, whatever age you are. And that's, something to be considered with this anti-vaccination campaign that's been, implemented by Secretary Kennedy. So let's talk about cold weather. You wrote about this in one of your newsletters. We're at 9 days of sub-freezing temperatures. I think the temperature may get above freezing today here in the Baltimore metro area, but we're close to setting a record for consecutive days of really, really cold weather. And folks need to be careful when it's this cold, when it comes to exercise and when it comes to staying healthy. What are some of the things that come to mind to you when we think about cold weather and avoiding problems therein?
Well, there are two competing considerations, because on the one hand, people still need to exercise and get physical activity. I certainly don't want people to look at the weather and say, well, this is just too dangerous and I'm not going to exercise, because staying inactive is dangerous as well. But on the other hand, extreme cold has a number of health risks as well. You could get hypothermia, which is when the body overall loses more quickly than it generates. You could get frostbite, which is a more localized injury when tissues freeze. There could be impacts on specific body systems. So for example, individuals with respiratory issues, with asthma or COPD, they may have bronchospasms and may have more frequent asthma attacks when exposed to cold. And cold weather also affects the heart and is an additional stressor on the heart as well, especially if people are doing a lot of exertion in cold weather. And so and then there's the issue of ice and sleet and snow and all these things that are covering the ground at the moment, making running outside or exercising outside a bit difficult as well. And so what I would say is the safest thing to do, of course, is to move your exercise indoors during periods of bitter cold, like what we have been experiencing. And so that obviously is the best thing to do if you have access to a gym, if you have home exercise equipment. Even if you don't, and you can do body weight exercises like push-ups or doing a plank or things like that, that could also be part of your physical activity total. And then if you are going outside, there are things that you could do to reduce reduce your risk of getting cold-related illness. So, for example, making sure you pay close attention to the weather, try going during the day rather than early mornings or later in the evenings when it's colder, wear waterproof shoes that have grip, protect your exposed areas like your ears, wear gloves. And then I would say in general for people who are runners, even if you are a regular runner, you're used to running a lot, be prepared to adjust your routes. Short loops and out and back routes will allow you to just assess how you're feeling and then to turn around. And then it's always important to let people know of your plans, because one of the symptoms of hypothermia, of low body temperature, is confusion. And people may not recognize that that they're getting disoriented and that they need to seek a warm area. And so going with somebody else is always better. But if you're not able to, let someone else know where you're going, allow tracking on your phone, share your location. And I say the same thing goes with kids as well. Knowing that kids may lose body temperature faster than adults, and also that kids are not always aware of when they're getting too cold. If they're going out, make sure that they have layered clothing, hats, gloves, footwear, and regularly check in with them and plan for time to warm up indoors before sending them out again.
What is the effect of cold on things like blood pressure? The coronary arteries and stress to the heart. Why does cold in particular seem to have a deleterious effect in that regard?
Yeah, this is really interesting. So the cold can constrict blood vessels, and that can then raise blood pressure. It can also constrict your coronary arteries and then just add stressors to the heart. Now, for the majority of people, this is not an issue. We stress our hearts just by walking quickly and running and doing basic exercise. But I think many people may have heard that of the anecdotes of heart attacks happening when people are shoveling snow. And that's led people to ask, well, is shoveling snow somehow just this really dangerous activity? Well, not really. It's not that shoveling is dangerous, although certainly people can injure themselves and injure their backs shoveling as well. But rather that it's a strenuous activity that not everybody may be used to, right? People may not be used to that level of exertion for that long. And then the cold weather, especially the extreme cold like we have been experiencing, is an additional stressor on top of that.
And you write a really strong suggestion about there are some everyday household chores that can count pretty well as physical activities. You can raise your heart rate. And you can, really make some progress physically, doing things like vacuuming and mopping and cleaning up the house. You get that benefit too. It's another off-target benefit to exercise, right?
Right. Yes, and you'll have a cleaner house at the end. So I think that may be the off-target benefit.
That's right. There's mental health, benefits as well. You wrote a column in the Post about aspirin. President Trump gave an interview to the Wall Street Journal, I guess, a week or so ago, where he talked about how he takes even more aspirin than his doctors recommend. In fact, there's been a bunch of research about aspirin intake for folks, particularly older folks like Mr. Trump. Where do you stand on that?
Well, I think that this is a case of recognizing that the science changes and that we have to follow the current guidelines, understanding that where it was before may have been different. So going back a bit, in the 1970s, 1980s, 1990s, there were a lot of studies showing that daily aspirin use reduces your chance of having heart attacks and strokes. And so the aspirin became a mainstay of preventing heart disease, and that was something that people just did, right? They took a daily aspirin. But then in the last decade or so, there has been a significant paradigm shift. Part of it is that there are other prevention strategies, like better management of blood pressure and diabetes, that have happened at this time, during this period. And so patients are now getting less benefit than earlier generations did from aspirin. The other part of it too is every time we think about a treatment, we think about the benefit or risk. The benefit is now less than we thought, or than it was. Also, the risks have become more apparent as well. A number of studies have shown that long-term aspirin use increases the chance of GI bleeding, of stomach bleeding. And it can also, if somebody falls or just in general, that there could also be some really tragic, devastating events like bleeding in the brain that could happen if somebody is using aspirin and let's say that they had a fall as well. And so a number of major medical associations, including the American Heart Association, American College of Cardiology, and then also the U.S. Preventive Services Task Force have since updated their guidelines. And I actually think that many people, and not just I think, but we know that many people are not aware of these guideline changes. And so specifically, the Preventive Services Task Force in 2022 recommended against starting aspirin for prevention of heart disease in people 60 and older, if they haven't previously had a heart attack or stroke. They said that people who are younger than 60 and have specific risk factors for heart disease could consider taking aspirin. But very specifically, it's against, they're recommending against starting aspirin in people 60 and older because the risks outweigh the benefits in people who do not have other who have not had heart issues in the past. Now, I do want to say that these recommendations don't apply to people who previously had heart attacks or strokes or bypass surgery or stents in their heart. For many of these individuals, they should be using a regular aspirin and they should be using another blood thinner, that standard of care, because that's what's called secondary prevention, preventing a second or subsequent event, rather than for primary prevention, preventing something from happening in the first place. But we know, based on a number of studies, that people are not aware of these recommendations. Many people still think that because aspirin is sold over the counter, that is essentially harmless, and they're taking an aspirin a day and maybe not even mentioning it to their physician, not discussing that recommendation with their physician. And my suggestion, my counsel here is, you should discuss it with your doctor. It may well be that you should still be on aspirin if you've been taking it for a long time. Or maybe you feel better taking aspirin, and if there's no significant risk, then you can continue taking aspirin. But especially if you're older, if you're thinking of starting aspirin, it's a conversation that needs to be had with your clinician about whether this is the right move for you, knowing that in many circumstances, this may not be the right move for you because the risks may outweigh the benefits.
Yeah, and it's also a matter of obviously of risk and reward, but also the amount of aspirin that you're taking. Mr. Trump evidently has ignored the advice that his physicians have given him to take just a small amount of aspirin. I think the baby aspirins now are 85 milligrams or something, and a regular aspirin might be 350 milligrams. He's taking the regular one instead of the smaller dosage. So it's just a matter of being rational about it. And again, you know, we all should be consulting our physicians, and the president's consulting his, and evidently, according to the Wall Street Journal, deciding that he's going to ignore the advice of his physician. We need to take a quick break. Before we do, let's go to the phones. Let's go to Dan. He's on the line in Baltimore. Welcome to the program with Dr. Lena Nguyen.
Thank you very much. I think we can all pretty much agree that Mr. Kennedy is a charlatan. And my suggestion is that we treat him as though we treat any other charlatan practicing medicine. Most practitioners of public health are experienced. They are trained and they are licensed. So why can't any jurisdiction, I would suggest Maryland, cite him for practicing medicine or public health without a license, and just letting the courts decide? It's a novel, audacious concept, but I think it's terribly warranted by the extremity of his impact on our health infrastructure. And I'll take your answer off the air.
All right. Well, thank you for that call, Dan. I appreciate it. But obviously, Lena, I mean, Mr. Kennedy isn't practicing medicine in the way that, you know, physicians practice medicine with their patients, but he has any number of doctors serving on his committees and his advisory panels that are cheering him on, doesn't he?
Right. And this is the issue. Look, I have no idea the legal aspects of what the listener just recommended. I have no idea if that's a good legal strategy or not. I do know that there are a number of lawsuits that are currently pending, especially based on process, because for example, the changes just made to the CDC's vaccine recommendations did not go through the usual process of having the experts that in this case, Secretary Kennedy wiped out the entire slate of former experts and replaced them with his own so-called experts, but even they did not make these recommendations for these really dramatic sweeping changes to the childhood immunization schedule. And so I think there are some legal questions around that. But to your point, Tom, you're right. There are individuals that Secretary Kennedy has found to populate his expert panels, many of whom have views that in the past would have been labeled quite extreme and fringe, but now they make up the majority of the individuals on his advisory panel. But again, he's not even using these advisory panels to do the work that they're supposed to do. The childhood immunization schedule was changed, not having gone through even this handpicked panel, which I think is another one that is. It just speaks to how arbitrary is the nature of these decisions and how not transparent they are as well.
Yeah, and it speaks to an abandonment of expertise and a respect for people who are in fact experts in various fields. Dr. Lena Nguyen is a former health commissioner of Baltimore and a columnist for the Washington Post. Her latest book is Lifelines: A Doctor's Journey in the Fight for Public Health. Dr. Nguyen is with us until the top of the hour. You are welcome to join us as well. 410-662-8780. Our email, midday@wypr.org. We're going to take a quick break, but first, it is our practice here on Midday to read the names of people who have lost their lives to violence in Baltimore City and to list their names on the Midday webpage. We get them from a researcher named Ellen Worthing and from the Baltimore Police Department. Police have identified 10 people who have been killed so far this year. Jamel Dixon, age 36, was killed the week before last. One person was a victim of homicide in Baltimore last week. Michael Ramseur was 36 years old. It's midday. I'm Tom Hall. We'll be right back.
This is 88.1 WYPR.
And welcome back. It's Midday. I'm Tom Hall. If you've just joined us today, it's the Midday Health Watch with Dr. Lena Nguyen. She's a former health commissioner of Baltimore, a columnist for the Washington Post. She's a scholar at George Washington University in the Brookings Institution, and she is a medical expert for CNN. You are welcome to join our conversation with Dr. Nguyen, 410-662-8780. Our email is midday@wypr.org. So, Lena, I want to ask you about alcohol use. We've been talking about it a bit here on the show with Dry January. We did a segment about that. I had our good friend Monica Reinagle on last week. She's a terrific nutritionist. We were talking about, people giving it up for the month and whether there are nutritional benefits to that. But you frame it in a very helpful way, I think, in a column that you wrote for the Post, which was headlined, "What to Ask Yourself If You Think That You May Be Drinking Too Much." So how do you frame those questions to determine whether or not you think you've got to change your use of alcohol?
Yeah, thank you for that question, Tom. I think it's something that many people have been wondering about because you read the news and it seems like almost every week that there's something contradictory about alcohol, and how much alcohol is recommended, or whether just a little bit is terrible for you, or is it a lot, and so forth. And I think a lot of people are confused. And so here, so I wrote a couple of articles about this. One is about looking at where the evidence is clear and where there's a lot of uncertainty. So where the evidence is clear is that binge drinking is dangerous, which is binge drinking is defined as consuming four or more drinks on one occasion for women and five or more drinks for men on one occasion. We know that binge drinking is associated with car crashes and injuries, and also there are lots of injuries that could happen because alcohol is a toxin, and if you ingest a lot in a short period, it overwhelms the body's ability to metabolize it. And so you could get increased risk of heart rhythm problems and pancreatitis and other things with binge drinking. The science is also very clear that people who drink heavily on a regular basis, American Heart Association defines heavy drinking as four or more drinks per day, or binge drinking on five or more days in the past month. And at those levels of heavy drinking, alcohol use is increased with the risk with increased risk of basically every heart problem, including heart attack and sudden cardiac death. And of course, we know that there are a number of other organs involved with heavy drinking as well, including liver problems, and excessive alcohol use is associated with cancer, long-term brain damage, and premature death. And then I would say the third thing that people that with that the evidence is clear too is that that alcohol use disorder is very real. There are nearly 28 million people who meet the criteria for alcohol use disorder, meaning that they cannot control their drinking. They could experience physical symptoms like nausea or agitation when they try to stop, and they can also have serious impairments in their work or family or social function, which then doesn't just affect them but others around them as well. So I think that's where the science is really clear. And people should ask themselves, am I drinking too much on one occasion, which is binge drinking? Am I regularly consuming too much alcohol? And then also, am I experiencing these types of disruptions in my life? Can I reduce alcohol when I want to? Or I think a very important question to ask is, who has control? Is it you, or is it the alcohol? And this is one reason why you mentioned Dry January, Tom. I think Dry January is a very good exercise to try. Even if people don't want to do it for a whole month, they just want to do it for a week. It of course doesn't have to be in January. But just doing something that where people have to reduce their risk of alcohol intake, or stop their alcohol intake, or reduce or stop their alcohol intake, could help people find out, why are they drinking? Do they feel better when they stop drinking? Do they feel like they still want to drink even when they know that they are trying to stop, and so forth? So that issue of control is something that can really come across in an exercise like that. Now, where the science is much less settled is whether low levels of alcohol consumption, for example, one drink a day on average for women, two drinks a day on average for men, will still pose health risks if people are able to control their drinking. It does seem like there are a number of opposing views on this topic. So I would say that the science is not settled. There probably is a slightly increased risk of cancer, but I think the jury is out on whether this level of moderate or light drinking will increase mortality risk. And I think, it is clear that nobody should start drinking thinking that there are health benefits. But for people who are able to moderate their alcohol use, I think it's a more nuanced conversation, compared to individuals who clearly have health risks associated with their alcohol use.
Yeah, and again, Monica Roniegel and I were talking about the new dietary guidelines that again came out under the auspices of Health and Human Services, Mr. Kennedy. And when it comes to alcohol in the new dietary guidelines, it simply says drink less. It doesn't say drink less than what. It's very vague. And as you mentioned before, the general guideline for moderate drinking was, one drink for women, two drinks for men. And it's hard to know what the HHS is recommending when it comes to how much people, really can drink safely. But I think asking these questions about control, and if you have one drink, is that, are you satisfied? Is that fine? And can you decide not to have another drink after you've had the first one? Or does the first one, diminish your willpower so much that you really aren't in a position where you're going to be able to say, well, I'm not gonna have another one? It's asking those really important questions. I do want to go back before we run out of time. We have a question from an emailer about aspirin, so I want to back up for just a second here. And this is from Donald, who says, Dr. Nguyen, for older men, do you recommend that we still keep some aspirin in the car or with us other places in case of a surprise heart issue when we're not at home? In other words, if you're having a cardiac event, if someone thinks they're having a heart attack, is taking an aspirin at that moment going to help?
So this is a really good question. And actually, in the past, this is something that that people were told to do, that if you think that you may be having a heart attack, that while you're waiting for the ambulance to arrive, that you could be taking an aspirin. So it's actually not something that's typically recommended at the moment, and for a couple of reasons. One is that you don't actually know what you have. You may think that you're having a heart attack, but how do you know that you're having a heart attack? A lot of people have not had heart attacks before. How would they know that what they're experiencing is a heart attack? What if instead what you're having is a leakage of your heart vessels, of your blood vessels in your heart, and you're having an aortic dissection, in which case you don't want to be taking aspirin. And the other thing too is there may be instances if, let's say, that you think that you're having a stroke and you are taking aspirin. Well, maybe the amount that you took may prevent you from getting another medication that may be more helpful for you. So look, I'm not saying don't keep aspirin in your home. There may be other reasons why you may want to have an aspirin or having medication, knowing that there are medications with aspirin. For example, for some people, they like taking, if they have migraines or if they have severe headaches, they may have, they may keep medications containing Tylenol and aspirin to help with that. But I would say that this is another case where things do need to be specific for you. There may be some individuals with cardiac conditions who would benefit from taking aspirin if something like this were to arise. And again, there are individuals who should be taking a daily aspirin. I do want to make that clear. There are plenty of individuals who have had prior heart attacks, who have cardiac stents and so forth, who are being advised to take an aspirin or other blood thinner every day. But my point in all of this is these are really things that you should be discussing with your physician. Just because something is an over-the-counter drug does not mean that it's harmless. It is a therapy that, like others, has risks and potential benefits, and you should discuss all of those with your physician.
Yeah, that's really important to have those conversations because every patient is obviously going to be different. If you're a 100-pound woman, you're going to have a different need than if you're a 250-pound man. If you're older or younger, I mean, there's just a million different variations that are going to affect things. And again, to sort of ping pong back in our last 30 seconds here, when it comes to alcohol, you write that alcohol should not be used as a strategy to improve cardiovascular health in the same way that, you know, perhaps aspirin shouldn't be used either. I mean, there was this notion that a glass of wine every day was going to somehow improve your cardiac function, but research is showing that that's not necessarily the case.
Right. I mean, this is another one where the jury is out a bit. There have been a number of studies that have looked at this issue of does alcohol use somehow help your heart? And it turns out that there have been some studies showing that individuals who regularly consume a glass of wine have a lower risk of heart disease. However, when looking back at these studies, many of them have confounding factors, including maybe the individuals who are able to drink a glass of wine a day have a higher socioeconomic status. Maybe these individuals are healthier in other ways. And so there are confounding factors to take into account.
Yeah. Lots of different factors. And unfortunately, we're going to have to leave it there, Lena. I'm very sorry. We will pick it up again next month. Dr. Lena Nguyen, her latest book is Lifelines, A Doctor's Journey in the Fight for Public Health. Thanks so much.
Thank you.
And that's it for us today. Coming up tomorrow, we're going to talk about personal finance with the certified financial planner, Nick Abrams. I'm Tom Hall. Thanks for being with us. Have a great day.
This is member-supported 88.1 WYPR.